Quantum field theory 3. So in this course, we'll cover 3 separate topics. We'll have some connections between them, but we'll largely change direction each time we change lecturer. So in the first part of the course, I will discuss anomalies or quantum effects that spoil classical symmetries. Then in the second part of the course, Jaume will discuss conformal field theory, or theories that have a scale invariance in addition to other symmetries. And in the final part of the course, we'll have a brief introduction to string theory by Davide. So in a number of different courses, we've discussed Noether's theorem. Is one of the most important and useful results in theoretical physics. We've seen it from a number of different perspectives in classical physics course and quantum field theory 1, and possibly other courses as well. And so today, we are going to examine this further, and we'll see that Noether's theorem is a lie. So that's what I'm going to tell you today. Not quite. That's perhaps a bit of a strong statement. Noether's theorem is, of course, a theorem, so it's true if the assumptions are true, but it's a classical result. So Noether's theorem holds in classical mechanics. Once we include quantum mechanics, it is no longer true that a symmetry implies a conservation law. So a key assumption in Noether's theorem is that we're working classical mechanics. This works only classically. And so quantum effects that can spoil this are known as anomalies, and that's what we're going to study this week. So one important feature of anomalies is that they have both IR and UV effects. So anomalies can really tie together physics at different energy scales. So they are observable in the IR. They have important effects. We can, by doing low energy experiments or large distance experiments, we can determine if a system has a symmetry or not. One famous example, for those of you who took the Standard Model Below course, perhaps you would briefly discuss this, is there's a particle called the pion, which can decay to 2 photons. This is forbidden by a symmetry of the classical theory. Nevertheless, it's observed. And this decay rate can be predicted by computing the anomaly, or the size of the effect that spoils the classical symmetry. So something you can observe in the IR. Nevertheless, it's deeply tied to the UV physics. So as we'll see today and later this week, one way to think about where anomalies come from is that it in some cases it can be impossible of finding a regulator, a UV regulator, that respects all the symmetries. So it can be the case that you have a classical theory that has several symmetries. There's no quantum theory that respects all those symmetries. So when you quantize the theory, you need to pick some subset of those classical symmetries to be respected by your quantum theory. And we'll see this in a few different ways throughout the course, this part of the course. So this is going to be the focus of this week. And we're going to examine anomalies in a few different ways. So the most direct way to understand where anomalies come from is from the path integral or functional integral. We'll focus on that approach. So very briefly, an anomaly can arise when the measure of the functional integral is not invariant, even if the action is invariant under a symmetry. We'll examine that idea more in more detail later. But the first context we're going to examine anomalies is the 2D massless QED. We're going to study this in two different ways. So first, we're just going to develop some intuition. So I'm not going to be super careful in my first treatment of the anomalies. Just going to try to develop some intuition. And then we will see how to be more careful by using functional integrals. We'll start the functional integrals tomorrow. So there's two ways. First, the intuitive way, and there will be some steps that I'm not very careful, and then functional integrals. Again, the big idea behind functional integrals is our main object of study is the partition function. And we have a scalar field theory that's depending on the sign. We're in Minkowski space or Euclidean space. If there's a classical symmetry, then the action is invariant, but whether or not the measure is invariant will tell us that there's an anomaly. Okay. So before we dive into that, just I want to say a few things about notice theorem. Or before that, are there any questions at this point? So let's suppose we have a scalar field theory. Action is the standard action that depends on some Lagrangian function of the field and its first derivatives. We have a symmetry, then the action will be invariant if we do a symmetry transformation. Say we take phi to some phi plus epsilon, some small parameter, times some functional of phi. So if this is a symmetry, then the action is invariant. But there's another way we can derive the conserved current that you examined in the classical physics course. We can promote this parameter epsilon to a function of spacetime. If we do that, then the action is no longer invariant. The extra term we get is just the integral of the parameter epsilon times the divergence of the current. And so this is a useful way to find the divergence of the current. And in fact, a generalization of this is a way to determine whether or not the current is conserved in the quantum theory. So let's just briefly look at how we would generalize this to a quantum theory. These are known as Ward identities. And we'll start with some functional integral. This sign doesn't really matter here. We're in Euclidean or Minkowski space. And let's suppose we do a symmetry transformation or a change of variables in our path integral. We take our new variables to be just what we had over here. We do this change of variables in our functional integral. What we get is that z goes to integral e phi prime e to the I s phi. Then let's write the extra term we get as I epsilon x phi. Oh, sorry. This should be s goes to this. The integral of I epsilon dot divergence of j mu. So just use the result from classical physics. And we can then get from this equation, if we assume that d phi prime is equal to d phi, as an assumption, we assume this. This is a big assumption. We'll re-examine. We assume that, then we can Taylor expand the exponential and compare to our original functional integral to determine equations for the expectation value of j. So we Taylor expand this. We get integral phi, the I s of phi, and 1 minus plus I epsilon dot j mu phi. In higher order terms. Then we can compare to our original functional integral. If we're just doing a change of variables, we're not changing the value of our functional integral. So the first term is what we have. We started with. So all the other terms have to be zero. Particularly, they should be zero for every epsilon. So that means then that the expectation value, this term has to be zero for any epsilon, which tells us that the expectation value of d mu, k mu, is zero. And there are infinitely more equations, if we expand it to higher order, that constrain the expectation values of products of the currents. So these are the quantum versions of the conservation equation. So it's what you would expect. This is the way we can derive the quantum version of the conservation equation. D mu j mu is zero. And so this is a conservation equation, and our goal in deriving the anomaly will be to find the right-hand side of this equation. So this is zero if we make this assumption, not in general true. If the measure is not invariant, there'll be some non-zero other term here. And this is called the anomaly. The anomaly is what shows up on the right-hand side of this equation. This is known as the anomalous non-conservation equation. So that's our goal, is to derive that equation. And we're going to first not be so careful and make some inspired guesses, and then we'll later be more careful. Any questions so far? Okay. So one of the simplest contexts to understand where anomalies come from is 2D massless QED. In particular, the anomaly we're going to look for is the chiral anomaly. Anomaly in the chiral symmetry. Is one of the U1 symmetries of this theory. This theory is also sometimes known as the Schwinger model. My notes, I refer to it that way. And so our Lagrangian, just to briefly recall, is for a free fermion, I d slash psi, I psi bar d slash psi. In this theory, this has two U1 symmetries. We can give the fermion field a phase, and the Lagrangian is clearly an invariant under that. Noether's theorem tells us there's a conserved current associated with this U1 symmetry, which is denoted J mu and often called the vector symmetry. And there's another symmetry, which is known as the chiral symmetry, under which psi goes to e to the I alpha gamma 5 psi. And that's a symmetry because of the anti-commutation relations of the gammas. So psi bar transforms with the same sign in the exponent, transforms to psi bar e to the I plus I alpha gamma 5. And we get another sign flip when we commute this exponential past the gamma in the d slash. And so under these transformation laws, Noether's theorem tells us there's another conserved current. It's often called J5 mu. This is the axial current or chiral current. It looks very similar, just an additional gamma 5 here. So this is just for a free fermion. If I want to go to QED instead, these symmetries remain symmetries. If the photon field doesn't transform, all I need to do is change this partial into a covariant derivative. And these are still symmetries. And nothing I've said so far depends on whether we're in two dimensions or four dimensions. We discussed this in Q52 in four dimensions, but it also holds in two dimensions.
So here alpha is function of time. You don't need to.
No, so these are global symmetries. Yeah, so alpha is independent. So Noether's theorem applies to global symmetries.
But then you said you changed the covariant normal derivative to covariant derivative.
Oh, if I want to include a photon, but these are still global symmetries. Still global symmetries. There is also gauge symmetry, but we're going to focus on the global symmetry. So all of this works in 2D or 4D. And what we're going to see is that we basically, when we quantize this theory, we're going to have to choose which of these currents is conserved. So these two symmetries conflict in the quantum theory. So you might think there's a choice which one to conserve, but there isn't really, because the conservation of the vector current is closely associated with the gauge symmetry, which is essential for the consistency of the theory. So we're essentially forced to conserve the vector current, meaning that the axial or chiral current is not conserved. Okay, so we can see this conflict in a simpler setting. So ultimately, we'd like to treat this theory in a fully quantum manner. But it turns out that if you treat the fermion quantum mechanically and the gauge field as a classical background field, that's sufficient. You can see the this conflict. So we'll take that approach for now. It simplifies our life if we only have to deal with quantizing the fermion. Cool. We're going to try to quantize fermion and treat a mu classically. Okay, so if you want to study this theory, you can note that if we set a mu to zero, then we just have a theory of a free fermion. So that's a very simple theory that we can understand some of the quantum mechanics of very easily, and then we're going to turn on adiabatically the background gauge field. That's going to be our strategy. So if the gauge field is zero, then the equation of motion for the fermion is just I E0 plus or minus E1 psi equals zero, or equation of motion. A mu is zero. And the solutions to this are very easy to see. Just have a space and time derivatives, plus or minus sign. So solutions are plane waves moving to the left or right. So the left, if choose the plus sign, right if we choose the minus sign, with z equals 1. So all we're going to really need is the energy levels for the system. Yeah, so I'm, as I said today, I'm not going to be very careful. Tomorrow, we'll treat things using the functional integral. We can, just by looking at the equation of motion, we can determine the energy levels, all we'll need today.
Equation of motion is the classical equation. And say that phi is si is some operator.
That's right, yeah. So, again, we're not being very careful. We're just, what my goal today is to try to get the quantum energy levels for the field. The first field psi, treating a mu as a classical background field. And that's all we'll need. Okay, so this is the story. If a mu is zero, we want to be able to turn on a mu. And so let's discuss the classical theory of 2D electrodynamics. There's one immediate problem we see, which is that in 2D, the electric field produced by a point charge is constant, which means that the Coulomb potential grows linearly, leads to strong coupling. At large distances. There's one easy way we can fix this. Anyone have an idea how we could fix this problem? Really?
Make space-time finite.
Exactly, yes. We can, and one way to do that is to compactify. Make space-time. Or space, at least, periodic. So let's do that. We can fix this by compactifying. And we'll do it by making space periodic. And let's assume the periodicity is L. And let's assume that the coupling at the length scale L is times L is much smaller than one, so that our theory is perturbative for all length scales L or less. Okay, so it'll also be convenient for our discussion to gauge fix. And in general, if we're in periodic space, a mu can be written as the sum over some Fourier components. I'll call a mu of t, little a, times some cosines. And well, we have a gauge freedom, so we can take a mu to a mu plus derivative of some function. Let me call it beta. Not to be this. I can call it alpha. So if alpha is constant, then we go back to the case we're interested over here. And we can use this gauge freedom to simplify this expression. One thing we can do is we can use this gauge freedom to set one of the components of A, say the spatial component, A1. Instead of being a function of space time, you can set it just to be a function of time only. And we can do that by choosing alpha, basically to cancel off all of the n not equal to zero components of A1. And do that by just choosing alpha, so that if we take a derivative, we cancel off the terms, the other terms. So that's a big simplification. The spatial component is just time dependent, not spatial. Yes.
Sorry, just go back. What was your
E naught is the gauge coupling at the length scale L. So it'll run in general.
Understand how
So over here we were just considering the case that the background gauge field vanishes, in which case our fermion, classical fermion fields are just plane waves moving to the left or the right. And we want to understand what happens when we turn on the background gauge field. So this is the most general thing I can write down. If I gauge fix, I can write down a simpler form.
Mu has just the cos terms and not the sine terms, or usually when we take the
that will depend on the boundary condition. So if I could change that to a sine, this would be a cosine. It doesn't matter. After we gauge fix, it's still just independent. That's a choice. So this doesn't work for the n equals zero term. We can't get rid of that term. But we haven't exhausted all of our gauge freedom. If we're in periodic space, our physical fields, A mu and psi, have to obey our boundary conditions. They have to be periodic with period L. But this function alpha does not. There's no restriction that alpha necessarily has to be periodic. And we can choose an alpha that is not periodic that will preserve periodicity of A mu. And one way we can do that is by choosing alpha to be 2 pi n over Lx. X is just our spatial dimension. So if we take a derivative of this, this is a constant, which is periodic. This is not a periodic function, but its derivative is. And so by choosing alpha to be 2 pi n over Lx, that lets us shift A1 to A1 plus 2 pi n over L. So if space is periodic, in this gauge at least, the spatial component of the gauge field is also periodic. So in other words, this gauge field lives just on a circle with circumference two I over L.
We had some value of alpha to gauge fix to make A1 only a function of time.
Mm-hmm.
Then we are saying A1 needs to be, if it is a constant, means because A1 does not depend on X, so So anyway, it's periodic in X, right?
It's so A1 is independent of X in this gauge. So we can do that by choosing alpha to be that, but we can also take alpha to alpha plus this. We can do this change and then add in 2 pi n over L x. This is not periodic, but once we take a derivative, it is. And so we do this. This will shift A1 by A1 plus 2 pi n over L.
We want this.
We can do this. So these two gauge field configurations are gauge equivalent. So in particular, when we solve for the spectrum of the fermion, you know, we can use this fact. This fact will tell us that the spectrum, after we shift the background gauge field by 2 pi n over L, is the same as the spectrum before that shift. That will be important.
But making this change will not affect A1 again. It's when we fix a certain value of alpha to make A1 independent of X.
Mm-hmm.
And then we are saying we had something X dependent to it, to alpha.
To alpha. And then its derivative will just be a constant. So this tells us that if we do this shift, the spectrum of the fermion won't change. Okay. So in this gauge, we just need to consider spatially constant A1 that lives between 0 and 2 pi over L. And so if we want to find the spectrum.
I find this arbitrary because 2 pi n over L, why, how did any constant would do? Yeah. Why do you? You're saying that already it is some int. N is an integer. We don't need that always. If this argument is just.
Thank you, Manu. We also know that the integral of the gauge field around a closed loop is gauge invariant. So if we do an integral around space-time from 0 to L, that cannot change under a gauge transformation. So if we did not, we chose a different constant here, that would change. So the gauge invariance of the Wilson loop, or the gauge invariance of the integral of the gauge field along that closed loop is essential for using this normalization.
Saying that any vector potential, if it lives on circle, can kill it and make it constant.
It's a gauge invariant. The integral of a gauge field around a closed loop will be gauge invariant.
I'm living in circle and I have a vector potential on that. Is you Fourier transform that, right? So you want to say that any A that live in a circle, like gauge transformation, you can make it a constant? Because it seems 2 pi n over L is a constant.
Right.
So any gauge potential over circle can be a constant this argument. I want just to know the argument.
The argument, yeah. So the Wilson loops we're looking at are like the integral of dx of e to the I'm writing something down wrong. I'm blanking for a minute, but yeah, it's we're integrate the gauge invariant loops are the can I come back to that question? Yeah. I'll come back to that. Okay, so we want to define the spectrum of the fermion, and we're working in the case where psi quantum and A is classical, and we're going to make a further assumption that it's slowly varying. And we'll make one additional assumption, which is that the zeroth component is zero. We could include this. This is for simplicity. Well, both of these assumptions are for simplicity. Really, all of them. So slowly varying just makes it easier to find the spectrum and do that in a few minutes. The zeroth component of the gauge field controls the Coulomb interaction between the fermions. And so we're essentially working in the limit where that the coupling is weak. So this will be a subleading correction. We don't need to worry about that at leading order. We could include it, and it would provide subleading corrections to what we're about to do. So find the spectrum. Basically, we just need to solve the equation I d slash psi is 0. And if the stationary solutions to this should be proportional to e to the I and t times some spatial wave functions. And since we're in periodic space, psi n's should be proportional to e to the 2 pi I n x over L. And together, if we plug a wave function of this form into this equation, we get immediately that the energy levels are just plus or minus 2 pi n over L minus plus A1. So this is our spectrum. And now we can examine what happens to the spectrum when we slowly change A1. Well, let's first consider what the ground state is with A1, 0. Let's draw a picture. So there's two sectors. There's the left moving sector and the right moving sector. So one way I can indicate those two sectors by drawing two plots of the energy versus the momentum of the particle. So the right moving sector will have live on the line E equals P. The left moving sector will live on the line E equals minus P. And there are equally spaced energy levels in both the left and right moving sectors. So, right. Left. So let's indicate those energy levels as circles. And in the Dirac C picture, in the ground state, all of the negative energy states and zero energy states are filled, and the positive energy states are empty. Ground state has these states filled. And these are filled. These ones are empty. Okay. So then this is a simple picture. And we can now consider what happens if we slowly increase our background gauge field from 0 to 2 pi over L. So if we do that, the spectrum is mapped to itself using the fact that our gauge field is lives in on the circle. Physical configurations live on a circle. So if we do this transformation, this adiabatic increase of our gauge field, the spectrum is mapped to itself, and the occupation numbers will remain unchanged as well. If we do this adiabatic increase in the right moving sector, all of the states get mapped to the next lowest state, because of the sign over here. And the left moving states get mapped to the next highest state because of this difference in sign. Or left moving states get mapped upwards. The spectrum is mapped to itself. Occupation numbers remain unchanged. What happens, results after this, the gauge field increases from 0 to 2 pi over L, is that this state here becomes empty. and this state here becomes filled. After the adiabatic increase. So that tells us that we have an empty state over here. We can interpret as the presence of an antiparticle in the diroxy picture. And in the left moving sector, we have a new filled state, which we can interpret as presence of a particle. This adiabatic increase caused the creation of a particle-antiparticle pair. Let's compute the change in charge. Yes, Charlie.
Right, I'm a little confused just because I feel like the states at the origin kind of aren't really particles or antiparticles. They're kind of in the middle, right? It's confusing. Like, I guess it's not clear to me why it's an antiparticle instead of a particle.
Well, we essentially can choose a we could choose as our ground state, the state where these are filled, or they're both empty. But either way, after this change, we now have an additional filled state on this side and an additional empty state. So there is some ambiguity in exactly what you call the ground state. The change is unambiguous. Okay, so this change in...
And just this E equals P and E equals minus P is just because it is massless, or does it follow somehow from there? Because
it's because it's massless, yes. It follows from, yes, our original equation of motion. We saw that in the massless case, the solutions are just...
But that has nothing to do with that. Somehow, I was... confused that P, you are saying P to be 2 pi n by L or something like that, no, right?
So the energy levels, so we've assumed in deriving these energy levels that space is periodic, that our fermion is massless.
E equal plus B or minus B just by the virtue that it is massless. And
that's right.
Maybe that answers is.
Yes. The plus and minus refer to the left or the right moving vector. OK, so let's compute the change in charge. We have a antiparticle and a particle. So we've created a positive chirality antiparticle. And a negative chirality particle. So for a positive, that's because the antiparticle and particle are in the left and right moving, right and left moving vectors, respectively. So the electric charge, or the charge under the vector symmetry, is this doesn't depend on the chirality of the particles. So the electric charge of the antiparticle, say, is minus one. Electric charge or vector charge of the particle is one. But if we say that a positive chirality particle has a chiral charge of plus one, then this positive chirality antiparticle has a chiral charge of minus one. And this negative chirality particle also has a chiral charge, negative one. So change in our vector charge is zero. Good, what we expected classically. But the change And our chiral charge is minus 2. That is our first sign of the anomaly. So we created a particle-antiparticle pair. Had zero electric charge, but non-zero chiral charge. Transform. This is a violation of the conservation of the chiral current. And so we can use this to derive the anomalous non-conservation equation, or guess it more properly. I'll do that next time. And we'll see that this result lead to a correction to the equation. And we can essentially determine what goes on the right hand side of this. Not equal to 0. And we can determine the anomaly. We'll do that next time. All right.
So if I had sent it instead to minus 2 pi L instead of 2 pi L, we would have had delta QS equals 2 instead of minus 2, right?
That's right.
So this delta
Q5
not equal to 0 is because you compactified the space-time engage group.
It doesn't actually depend on the compactification. The compactification allows us to treat it perturbatively. But this anomaly is present. It's a non-perturbative result. So.
I'm just trying to understand too, like, is what's happening that, you know, I don't have a preference for left and right, but as soon as I make A1 like point in the right direction, because it's now 2 pi L, it's like pointing that way. Now I do know the difference between left and right because of what A is. Is that kind of what's happening?
Essentially, yes. Yeah, so
because it's gauge, it shouldn't matter, but it ends up mattering.
That's right. Yes, so yeah, the direction we change the gauge field determines whether we create a positive or negative chirality particle or antiparticle. So the different chiralities couple in different ways to the gauge field. That breaks that symmetry.
We didn't use anything here quantum mechanical. Everything was classical.
The only thing we used quantum mechanical was the spectrum is discrete.
Like if I start from that Lagrangian and write that Lagrangian in term of y right-handed and left, it becomes two different sectors of right-handed and left-handed. They nothing have to do to each other, right? They are independent. And I have a gauge and I have a global symmetry for right-handed separately,
mm-hmm.
left-handed separately. I have two quantum numbers here. Number of right-handed should be constant, and number of left-handed should be.
That's right.
But if I write these two in terms of that two quantum numbers, the first one becomes nr plus n. The second one is nr minus n.
Yes.
So if right-handed and left-handed are constant, those two quantum numbers should be also constant, because it seems they are commutative. But I don't understand what's happened. Like, if something bad happens there should be something wrong with NR and NL2, right? Because if we assume these are independent and these are commutative, those two also become independent.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. So the...
what happens between NL and NL?
We have two independent symmetries here. We can take linear combinations of them to write them as conservation laws for the left. Number of left-handed particles or right-handed particles. Because the vector symmetry is not broken and the chiral symmetry is broken, both of those linear combinations will be broken. So we won't because of the anomaly, we don't have conservation, as we see here, of either left or right headed particles. We created a positive chirality antiparticle and a negative chirality particle. So this explicitly violates conservation of left end.
It's pretty strange to me because in Lagrangian, two of them are completely independent, not in this sector. How is this symmetry? If just I close my eyes, I just think about Lagrangian. I have two independent operator and two independent sections.
But they both couple to the gauge field. The same gauge field. Okay, so next time we will, again, in this basic treatment, we'll see what the right-hand side of this is, and then we will start to do things more carefully using functional integrals. See you next time. Okay. See you then.